The following lecture is provided by Biblical Training. The speaker is Dr. Douglas Moo. For more information, go to www.biblicaltraining.org.
4:1-7. Just returning to a slide we used yesterday, remind you kind of where we are generally in the argument of the letter. Remember the central theological section here, and 3:7 to 4:7 I identified as kind of the main argumentative section here. We're going to come to a second one later today. And so 4:1-7 kind of ends this section, which in some ways is a little bit of a tack-on. You know, it doesn't fit real neatly into an ecclesio or chiastic structure here or something, and that's fine. You know, a lot of portions of Scripture just don't fit neatly into some of our, admittedly at times, artificial arrangements. Paul has used a lot of language throughout this section, particularly as we've moved into the latter part of it, focusing on childhood development, we might say. And of course, in a sense, that starts all the way back in 3:7 and following, when he's talking about Abraham's descendants or children or seed. And so this language brings up the whole connotation, context, image of family life, as it were. And that's what Paul now uses in 4:1-7 to sort of make his final point about what he's been saying theologically. He was going to read 4:1-7 for us in his preferred version of the Bible. I think it's the one he preaches from normally. So, we're going to ask you to read 4:1-7, okay? Follow along in your own translation again, please.
Now, let me say this. All the while, an heir is a minor. Even though he's a legal owner of the whole estate, he's really no different from an employee because he's under guardians and administrators until the appointed time set by his father. So it is with us Christians. When we were minors, we were ruled by the deeply entrenched patterns of the culture. But when the time for our manhood came, God sent forth his son through a woman and into the southern system in order that he might rescue those called by the system and we might receive our full sonship. Because you're now sons, God has implanted the spirit of his son in our hearts, and we murmur, Father, Father. So you aren't a slave anymore. You are a son. And if you're a son, you are, through God, a noble heir of the heritage.
Most of you can identify the cotton patch version of the Bible that Hugh has read from here, which is an interesting take on translation, trying to set a translation right into the culture, hence the reference to the southern system you might have heard. I think throughout Galatians, Clarence Jordan, you know, in place of the law, talks about the southern system, and instead of Jews and Gentiles, he talks about blacks and whites, and I think Jerusalem becomes Atlanta, doesn't I believe? And so that's contextual translation taken to an extreme that ceases to be translation. But it's interesting to hear that refreshing way of putting things. I hope you notice, for instance, along the way there, the entrenched patterns of the culture or something of that kind, to translate a really important phrase here that's much debated, so we'll have to take a look at that. But some of the basic imagery of a child who is in an important family, who is identified as an heir, but is still in their childhood, coming to maturity that arises from that. So, if you look at the end of chapter 3, Paul ends with the language, heirs according to the promise. So it's natural he picks up that language at the beginning of chapter 4, that as long as an heir is underage, he's no different from a slave, though he owns the whole estate. That's the NIV now. In other words, the child is still subject to guardians and trustees, verse 2. The son, as important as he might be, key member of the family and the one who's ultimately going to receive the whole estate, is being watched over by these guardians and trustees, where I think we find a pretty clear parallel to the paidagogos we talked about yesterday, back in 3:24 to 25, where we saw, again, Paul using that language of the slave who watches over the child in their early years. You can see how Paul is picking up that same idea here again. Then in verse 3, when we were underage. Now, as I recall, Clarence Jordan takes that to be us Christians. Let's reflect just on that a minute. Who is Paul talking about here? Who is the we? We talked about these pronouns yesterday, remember? They're challenging. Paul shifts them sometimes in ways that seem difficult to predict and difficult to track in any neat, simple way. When we were underage.
Could we assume that since he's writing a letter to the Galatians, he's talking about?
It's certainly, obviously, a possibility. You know, that's one thing that comes to mind. And you see Paul doing this pretty often in the letters he writes. We, that is, you and me. You who I am addressing, generally, obviously, a Christian audience and often a Gentile Christian audience, certainly in this case. The other option is, of course, what? That he's thinking of Jews. Yeah, because Paul is both a Christian and a Jew. And we've seen that in Galatians, he is concerned to talk about a distinctly Jewish experience at times. Again, 2:15 is the key verse here. We who are Jews by birth and not Gentile sinners. So there, you know, it's a very clear point where Paul identifies himself with the Jewish people. And so it could be he's talking here about, in a sense, the people of Israel and the history of Israel. When God's people Israel were in an early stage of development, they were under guardians and trustees, that is the law. They were going to be heirs one day, that is, God was going to, you know, fulfill his promises to them. He was going to bring them to their maturity, as it were, as his people, and that was going to happen at the time set by the Father. See that language there? So this is a typical thing that sometimes you do when you use an illustration like this. You bring in part of the application you're making to the illustration itself. The point being this, as far as we know, we can't find any evidence that in the ancient world of Paul's day, the father had the right to sort of set the time of the inheritance in this way. And so it doesn't match very well what we know from legal procedure, legal situations in Paul's world, but obviously is intended to reflect the theological application Paul is making. God himself, the Father, set the time when his people would come to full maturity. I tend to think that the we here might be Jewish people rather than Christians in general. I would suggest that that might be the case also back in verses 23 to 25. I don't know if we talked about that yesterday. We were held in custody. The law was our guardian that we might be justified by faith. I suspect the we there is probably also a reference to the Jewish people rather than to Christians in general. It's natural for us, partly in our interest to apply Scripture, homiletical expediency again, to read in light of, you know, our own audience and my own experience. Here, it's not an easy call. It might be appropriate to do so. Not necessarily clearly wrong here, but one of the things we need to do if we want to be good students of Scripture is sometimes to deliberately try to read in light of Paul's context rather than ours. Various theologians and people who are expert in hermeneutics talk about the two horizons. You've probably heard this imagery used before. We have the horizon of the text, first century document written by Paul, a Jew, to these Galatians. And then we have the horizon of our own current situation, 21st century, you know, called to preach the gospel, particular church, time and place, these two different horizons. The text of Scripture addresses both. God's word is not something that is just a historical artifact. You know, the Bible is very different than ancient philosophers or ancient plays. The Bible is a word of God that in some ways speaks to every generation of his people. So it addresses both horizons. But in order to understand what it means in our horizon, we have to go back sometimes and figure out that original horizon of meaning. And sometimes that requires a deliberate sense of distance that we put between ourselves and the text. To say, again, let me think about this text, you know, not just what's God saying to me in a kind of immediate way, but what's this text doing in the context in which it was first written? Then what's really important is that we collapse those horizons again, that once having done that, we then bring the fruit of that study and the understanding that we've gained and bring it into our own situation and context. So again, in a place like this then, while we might, you know, sort of in a default way and because we're interested particularly in application of the text, immediately think, well, this we is talking about all of us, and so I can, you know, preach this directly to all of you, my congregation. It's possible that's what's going on here. And there is some overlap we're going to see, but it might be Paul's thinking, first of all, of the experience of the people of Israel and helping these Galatian Christians then understand here was the role that God's law had in the life of Israel. And obviously, we learn a lot from that ourselves in terms of its role in our lives, but it may not be that we can identify ourselves quite that neatly with the text. Any questions on translation in verses 1 to 3? I'm sorry, 1 to 3a. I want to look at the end of verse 3 in a minute. Anything, again, in your versions and your translations that stands out as worthy of mention, comment, question?
You know, it talks about guardians and trustees. Are those words used elsewhere to give us some sort of a wider context is what Paul's talking about.
These words are fairly rare. They're kind of legal terms from Paul's world, but I think they're quite similar to the paedagogos in 3:24 to 25. In this case, again, you think of the guardians, you know, the people who are administering the will, let's say, of a father, where you have a minor child and you appoint guardians of that child, particularly if parents have died, perhaps. Pretty comparable to the situation we would be familiar with in that way. So, for instance, you know, if you have a child who is the heir to a wealthy estate and the parents have died, while that child is still young, the court will appoint trustees to control the money and the estate, and it won't be until the child reaches a certain age that they will then have full rights to the estate. It's that kind of a situation Paul is envisaging here, I think.
Verse 5, to me, go back to, again, to refer to this more to the Gentiles or to...
The pronouns, yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yep.
To redeem those who are under the law so that we might receive the adoption of sons. So that makes me lean more toward the Gentile audience than the Jewish audience.
Yeah, and I understand that. It gets complicated because then in verse 6, look what Paul does, because you are his sons. You know, he just refuses to be consistent. And that's what makes it hard, you know. It really does. Now, let's look at the end of verse 3. Here we have a very interesting phrase that's received a lot of debate, and here our translations differ a lot. Let me quickly move ahead to slide on this point. The Greek here uses a word stoicheia. It's a plural, sometimes translated elements. It would be one way to translate the word, the stoicheia of the world. And you could see here just from some of the versions that they're pretty much all over the place on how to translate this particular phrase. It occurs also in Colossians 2:8, exactly the same phrase, and you get exactly the same debate there. A number of interpreters, and this is reflected in both the NIV and the NRSV, think there's evidence that in Paul's day this phrase was beginning to be used of spiritual forces, spiritual beings. Of course, the world of Paul's day, as we know, people had a very lively sense of the way in which their own world was governed by these spiritual forces, gods, goddesses, spiritual beings of various kinds. Astrology was huge in the ancient Roman Empire because people were anxious to do things to try to get the gods on their side, to get the spiritual forces aligned in their favor. And a lot of the ancient religion was oriented toward trying to appease these spiritual forces in various ways. So one possibility here is that Paul is saying that whether Jews or people in general were once under these kinds of spiritual beings, these spiritual forces, as it were. We should note that Paul comes back and uses a similar phrase in verse 9. Now that you know God, or rather are known by God, how is it that you're turning back to these weak and miserable forces? There's the same word again now, these weak and miserable stoicheia. There it's clear that the Galatians were affected by these, whatever the stoicheia are, however we take the pronouns here at the beginning of chapter 4. So, spiritual forces. Let me look at some of the other options and talk a little bit more broadly in a moment. A second direction we can take, you find this in the ESV and the NLT, is to think that the word stoicheia refers to elementary principles. There's some evidence this word was being used for things like, the fundamental laws of nature or the fundamental laws of music, the way music works, and the way harmonies and melodies function and so on. Elementary principles. And here, the reference then could be to spiritual principles or rules, that people lived under. Various laws, not only the Torah, but laws of their own making as well. People live under these kinds of principles. A third direction of interpretation is to see the word referring to a more material thing, the material elements of the universe. This is clearly how the word is used in 2 Peter 3. King James may suggest this way of taking it. It's not clear what is involved in the King James translation there. This view, the idea, again, would be picking up some of the ideology of the ancient world, according to which the actual physical nature, the physical makeup of the world, again, is seen to have spiritual significance. Some of you know the four basic elements of the world in the ancient world were, let's see if I can remember them, air, fire, water, and girth, or ground, right? I think those were the four stoicheia, as it were, that the ancients thought everything was made up of. I'd just like to make a couple of comments here. One, if you look at the actual usage of this word in Paul's day, my own judgment is that the third meaning is by far the most likely. And again, a number of other scholars have said basically the same thing in recent years. The first view, while very popular, as far as I can see, there just is no clear evidence that this word was being applied to spiritual forces in Paul's day. A little bit later, yes, but I'm not I don't see the evidence for it in Paul's day. And I think this idea of the material elements does make sense. We think of texts like this, one in Deuteronomy, one in the Jewish writing of the intertestamental period. When you look up to the sky and see the sun, the moon, and the stars, all the heavenly array, do not be enticed into bowing down to them and worshiping things the Lord your God has apportioned to all the nations under heaven. The kind of persistent temptation in various forms of pagan religion to worship the elements, the material of this world, reflected also, again, in a time much closer to Paul, probably 1st or 2nd century B.C., all people who are ignorant of God were foolish by nature, and they were unable from the good things that are seen to know the one who exists. nor did they recognize the artisan while paying heed to his works, but they supposed that either fire or wind or swift air or the circle of the stars or turbulent water or the luminaries of heaven were the gods that rule the world. You see again here the tendency that the author is warning about for the Gentiles, the pagan world, to get caught up in these physical things and begin giving them significance in a religious or spiritual way. So it seems to me that way of taking the phrase is the most likely here. When you were under the material elements of the world, the kind of these fundamental building blocks of nature that were being accorded religious significance. Now, just to reflect on this a little bit more, because this kind of is an interesting idea that has not only controversial in Paul's context, but also has the potential for different kinds of application in our day. In Paul's context, what is quite stunning about this is that he suggests the Jewish law somehow is to some degree in the same category as these elements of the world. Now, I deliberately use the adjective stunning. You know, for a Jew who has grown up with the Torah and understands it to be God's gift to Israel, and Romans 7 makes clear Paul continues to view it that way, for him to associate God's own holy law with these sort of pagan religious practices is a daring move to make. And it's created considerable controversy ever since Paul wrote this. I mentioned yesterday, I think, that there are some scholars that go so far as they go, Paul's pretty clear here. He doesn't think the Jewish law is from God at all. You know, it's maybe from another god or a bad thing given by the angels, these spiritual forces of some kind. He is that negative about the law here. I think that's an overreading. I think that creates tremendous problems to make sense of what Paul says elsewhere, to maintain the unity of Scripture. So I don't think that's an option at all. But again, here in kind of a polemical thrust, Paul is suggesting that to go back under the law, particularly for these Gentiles, would be like going back under their earlier pagan system of religion. And he's trying to warn them in very strong terms about doing that. The point I'm making here, that for Paul's way of viewing things, and go back to this slide just for a moment, the material elements given a religious significance, you have the pagan ceremonies, and then you have, and I'm putting in quotation marks here, aspects of Torah, just kind of to remind myself of an important point. In 4:9, where Paul uses this phrase again, in the context there he talks about them worshiping, being tempted to observe days and months and seasons. The reference there would be obviously to Jewish holy days, the festivals, the feasts, perhaps the Sabbath, which again kind of have something to do with the material world. We know that the Galatians are being pressured to be circumcised. We know that dietary issues probably are part of the package here as well, although Paul doesn't go into that. In other words, material things. Circumcision is a material thing. Food that you eat and don't eat, material things. Following the calendar to some extent is kind of a material thing. And so I think this is the way Paul is suggesting that to put themselves under Torah is to some degree and in some sense like putting themselves back under their pagan ceremonies that they were accustomed to before they came to Christ. Let me pause here. Comments, questions on that?
I'll just say something that I reflect on, and part of that hermeneutic gap, the distant world, the pagan world. You know, like last year, if you had told me pagan ceremony, I really wouldn't know what that meant. This year, I went down to the neo-pagan story town, like an emerald shop, see what's in there. And, you know, you got all these herbs, you know, that do things. Celery seeds that have certain powers. If you do certain things with them, this happens. And rocks that you can buy that do. It just hit me. It's like, that's, there's this belief of powers in created things.
That's not gone away.
I had no way of imagining.
Yeah.
And, but if that's what that was like, then I could see the element of the powers in the creative world. A religious system is built on that. And it hasn't gone away.
That's a good point. That's a very good point. What people talk about, the new paganism, becoming increasingly popular in a lot of parts of the world. I know places like the Pacific Northwest, it's rampant, for instance. So different parts of the world are seeing kind of just a renewal of that in intense ways. You know, I think Jason's point that he's raising is a good one. A lot of this stuff is very parallel to the kind of pagan system that these Gentiles in Galatia would have been familiar with. I mean, obviously the specifics would differ in a lot of ways, but there's something kind of common there. It goes all the way back to Deuteronomy. You have Moses warning the people then about kind of a similar thing there. People are looking for some kind of spiritual experience, and if they don't find it in the true God, they're substituting other things for it. And again, what Paul's doing here in a very daring way is suggesting wanting to go under that law, the Jewish law, with all of its, you know, positive things, has a parallel with that.
But even more sinister is a synergism of adapting some of these and putting religious titles in. For instance, the emphasis of angels. And in other countries, like in Latin America, they still, even in church, in evangelical churches, they say, oh, I gave you the evil eye by admiring this, or something like that. And rather than renouncing the whole pagan practice, there's some of it that creeps insidiously into into the evangelical church.
Yeah. It's great that we're immune from that, isn't it? That we, in our context here, we never bring anything from our culture into our faith or the church. So that was irony, in case you didn't catch that. So, a wider issue, and you might remember Cotton Patch Version here that Hugh read for us. How do they translate end of verse 3? Hugh, do you remember? Can you check it there for us real quick? End of 4:3.
When we were minors, we were ruled by the deeply entrenched patterns of our culture.
Deeply entrenched patterns of our culture. One of the popular moves that has been made by a number of theologians in the last 30 to 40 years is to find in Paul's language of the elements or the powers. You know, he talks about rulers, thrones, dominions, principalities in various texts. Is to think that Paul here is ultimately reflecting on not just these personal spiritual beings, but also the systems, the cultural patterns that these spiritual beings propagate. One of the problems we have in reading our New Testament and applying it today is finding where it might attack what we would call structural evil. A lot of emphasis on individuals who are sinful, personal being, Satan, who is evil, even, you know, again, spiritual powers that exercise evil influence. But there's deep concern among a lot of Christians in our day that we also look at systems, cultural patterns that are profoundly evil, contrary to the truth of the gospel. And how do we find good New Testament basis to talk about those? Well, we can go to passages like this one, the elements, the principalities, the powers, and find there the ideal in a kind of implicit or extended way of these patterns. Now, this has been very popular in so-called liberation theology. So that liberation theologians will often say these evil patterns consist of things like capitalism, imperialism. Liberation theologians often are working in parts of the world where the government is savagely repressive, totalitarian, where the rulers are after their own good and are quite happy to keep all their people in poverty if they can build another mansion for themselves. We all know, you know, what that looks like, and these liberation theologians, you know, in a system like that, were wanting to say, preaching the gospel and helping people get to heaven ultimately is fine, but we want to help people here and now too, and we need to attack these oppressive systems, and that Christians should be in the vanguard of exercising their right to protest about these current evil spiritual cultural forces. Other Christians who are not in the liberation theology movement have picked that up and looked at that in a variety of other ways. The concern in our day of patterns in our culture and in the government to obliterate the difference between male and female, same-sex marriage, transvestite recognition. I was talking to a person who is the chief legal officer for Texas A&M University, not a liberal institution, not a liberal part of the country, who's saying we're having to completely redo all of our dormitories and rewrite all of our rules to accommodate transvestites, those who do not want to be identified as either male or female. We're having to figure out how to relabel all of our restrooms on campus to acknowledge that reality. Well, yeah, we all know, I don't have to tell you that this is a strong current in the culture right now. And the point is, people have tried to find a handhold here in some of these texts to look at these patterns of society as evil recognized by the New Testament authors themselves and something that we need to resist as Christians as well. I'm not so sure that the exegetical basis for this move is very sound. When Paul talks about the stoicheia, I don't think he has these patterns in view. He's talking about material elements. When he talks about principalities and powers and these other beings, he pretty clearly has personal spiritual beings in view rather than patterns of society. So without in any way suggesting we shouldn't be concerned as Christians to stand against patterns in society that we think are profoundly anti-Christian, I'm not sure these texts give us that clear ground to do so.
Is he using the same terms in Ephesians 6:12?
Well, no. He's not using the word elements or stoicheia there, no. That's again, one of these texts where you have the principalities and the powers, the rulers, the authorities.
The forces of evil.
Yeah. But it's not the same word as we have here. The word we have here only occurs in Paul here, Galatians 4, 3 and 9, and Colossians 2, 8. Yeah, James.
As you read Paul, do you see him believing that there are forces behind governments?
It was certainly a lively view in his day.
Kind of come out of him, do you read that?
It's possible. There are places where it's just really hard to make a distinction. There are a couple passages in Ephesians where Paul seems to link secular authorities with spiritual beings behind them. So I think there can be a little bit of a basis for that, for us to be able to look at certain rulers and say, these are demonic forces. And the battle, as you know, Ephesians 6 reminds us, is not simply about the battle between good and evil in a worldly sense. It's good and evil in an ultimate spiritual, cosmic sense. It's one of the things Ephesians, of course, does. Of all the letters of Paul, it introduces that whole level of the cosmic struggle that's going on, along with Revelation, of course, doing the same thing, that the battles we are fighting down here are simply reflections of a bigger cosmic battle going on. That's why I like reading the fiction of C.S. Lewis, because I think he, in his fiction, very dramatically creates a sense of that world. That is, a world thoroughly, again, penetrated by the spiritual forces that sometimes we can naively go along not recognizing.
Just kind of a follow-up question.
Yeah.
Do you see in Paul, as he's talking about those governmental systems, do you see him attacking the systems of his, the particular systems of his day? Or does he leave the systems untouched and talk?
He pretty much ignores the systems. And that's what frustrates a lot of contemporary Christians who want to find some basis for their protest of what they think are unjust governments.
You don't see it in Paul. You read
it. It's very hard to find in Paul. I think you see it in Revelation a little bit more with the language of the beast and so forth. I think there you see more of a sense of here is a demonic system that Christians must resist and not take on the authority and bow the knee to the emperor or the system he represents. So there I think you have it a little more clearly. And that's why the theology of Revelation is so important in that way. You know, and sometimes in certain Christian traditions we go to Revelation to kind of get a blueprint for what's going to happen in the future. And whether or not that's a good thing to do in Revelation, we shouldn't ignore the rich theology of the book, which hits exactly some of those kinds of issues.
Do you think that there is an association between people who are following the new perspective on Paul to have greater sympathy for this system deal, kind of tying into...
There certainly is a parallel, Jim. I'm not sure how genetic it is in a sense of, you know, kind of automatic if you're new perspective, you're doing this as well. But certainly, yeah, a lot of the writings of N.T. Wright emphasize this. James Dunn has emphasized this. Certainly some of Wright's students like Sylvia Kiesmott, Brian Walsh, and others have really heavily emphasized this thing. So, again, I think we all understand the issue. And to some extent, it could be a caricature. Again, the new perspective saying all traditional Christians are concerned about is getting individual souls to heaven. Soul saving is all they're concerned about. And they have tragically manifested a failure to deal with the issues of this world and this life. We need to hear the criticism. I think it's a bit of a caricature. I think that thoroughgoing conservative evangelicals who are not new perspective at all have been in the forefront of establishing hospitals overseas, for instance. And so I think, again, it's an unfair accusation in many ways. But I think it is a good reminder that our call to be Christian means to have thoroughly Christian ways of thinking in which we need to analyze our culture carefully and not just sort of endorse whatever is going on or turn a blind eye to what's going on. It's too easy to do that. And so I think their way of getting there is always not, to me, exegetically as sound as it might be. They've certainly taken it to an extreme at times, but there's something there, too, for us to learn from, I think. Rod, yeah?
Dr. Moon, a moment ago you said that something to the effect of, don't get me wrong, I think we should stand against the currents of evil systems and patterns. In what way should we go about that? I've often wondered, how would the Apostle Paul approach those things, or would he sort of take a back seat and say,
yeah,
that's not our calling as Christians. We're coming to Christ and live the gospel out and invite people into the kingdom, but you don't really see him taking a very strong stand against the evil systems of his day.
No, that's right.
And so what text would you even go to? Because you did say, in some sense, we should stand against the current. Are there some texts in the New Testament that would lend themselves to our being actively engaged in?
Yeah, I think again, the book of Revelation gives us a lot of theological basis there. In Paul, it's very hard to find, you know, texts that relate to that in a specific way. But you have a lot of passages in Paul, obviously, that warn Christians about being conformed to this world, about the importance of being transformed. And again, I think sometimes we have failed to see that that has a pretty broad application. That it's not just, oh, I'm going to think a new way about myself and my own spiritual journey, but transformed in my thinking about my culture, my world, and then taking appropriate measures, granted my culture and system of government, to do something about it. Paul, in the Roman Empire, doesn't have the same options we have in a democratic society, and that's where the translating, you know, Paul into our current situation is a difficult one. I think evangelicals historically have been rightly concerned that our appropriate highlighting of evangelism can get lost if we get too involved in these other things, you know, and that's a legitimate concern because that can happen. That's one way Satan can disrupt the effectiveness of our preaching of the gospel by getting us involved in all these other things instead of evangelism, which has to be the heart of what we do as a church and as Christians. But it shouldn't be an either or, is my point. Language in Paul, to go back to your question specifically, language in Paul about the thoroughness of being transformed in our thinking then gets translated into questions of how, what does that look like in my time, in my culture, in my society, in terms of the government that I live under? What does a transformed mind, how does it express itself, and how does it live itself out in that situation? Did I see Jason?
Yeah, I was just going to ask about Philemon and if you felt like there was any...
Philemon doesn't really... What's interesting about Philemon is that while Paul's talking about personal relationships, he doesn't, you know, try to lead a charge against the institution of slavery.
I think it's appropriate to take it beyond that in terms of more you do around
it. You know, I think if we look at Philemon and look at some other texts of the New Testament, they make clear, in my view at least, that the owning of another human being is not something that is consonant with the gospel or the transformed mind of the Christian. So clearly that means I shouldn't own slaves. The question Rod's asking, and a lot of Christians ask, is, well, does that mean then that I need to campaign against the institution of slavery as a Christian? Do I need to be a Wilberforce and engage in that kind of cultural, societal level? And I think myself the answer to that question is yes. There's plenty of evidence in the New Testament itself that I am supposed to be salt in my world. I'm supposed to be both light and salt. And I need to have a concern for this world and things that I consider evil that become entrenched as evil. I need to attack at that level as well as my personal level. So my own individual level, the church, and ultimately society as well. So it's a whole interesting area that, you know, we keep asking, well, where are the texts? And this is an issue that's hard to get a hold of by virtue of text. It's a broader theological issue. There's this whole area of called political theology, trying to think about politics in the broader sense of that word in a theological way, which just, I think, sometimes bypasses many of us. We're not aware of that. We don't think in those terms. But to engage as faithful Christians in our society, I think we need to be a little bit more up to speed on some of that. We're getting way off Galatians 4 now, moving steps and steps away. So I want to bring us back to Galatians 4 as Paul, again, continues now to talk about, in my view, perhaps the Jewish people especially, although we've seen there's some question about that. That when the time had fully come then, here's God determining the time, you see, God sent his son, fully human, he was born of a woman, and he was born under the law. He was a Jew who lived under the law. God's son came under that law himself. He lived under that law. He was a Jew and lived as a faithful Jew throughout his life. Even though he didn't always follow the oral law of his day, we know that Jesus, you know, infringed the oral law at times, his Sabbath behavior, for instance. Nevertheless, there's no evidence that Jesus ever violated the written law of God. He seemed to live throughout his life as a faithful Jew. Why? Because until his death and resurrection, the old covenant and its law was still in place. Jesus was, you know, a Jew under that law, living under it. But ultimately, in his death, came to redeem those under the law. He identified with people under the law and in his sacrificial death bought them out from under that slavery to the law and to the sinfulness that resulted. So that we might receive adoption to sonship. Again, the we here, maybe Paul shifted now to a broad application to Christians. It's hard to think that this is only applicable to Jewish Christians here. The language of adoption is a technical Greco-Roman legal term that talks about those who were outside a family being adopted into a family with all the rights and privileges of that family. The best example from Paul's own day is how Julius Caesar, the first sort of emperor of Rome, not having any physical children, biological children of his own, adopted Augustus, who became emperor next, of course, who adopted Augustus to be his son. And because Julius Caesar adopted him, he became emperor after Julius Caesar. He was entitled to all the rights and privileges of being the Caesar, the emperor after Julius. And that's the experience we enjoy, in which then, because we are his sons, we have the Spirit, and we cry out in our own hearts, Abba, Father. Of course, Abba, the Aramaic word, used sometimes in physical family contexts, indicating the sort of intimate relationship that we enjoy with God. This is the word Jesus himself used in addressing God. Mark, is it 14:36? No, that's not right. Is it 14:36? Maybe it is 14:36. At any rate, yeah, Jesus in Gethsemane cries out to God, Abba. And the word he used in addressing God is the word he now enables us to use who are sons as he is a son. What's that? 14:36 is right. Okay, thanks. So, concluding point, verse 7, then you're no longer a slave, but God's child. And since you are his child, he's also made you an heir. From being a slave to a son, being an heir, now then, of course, looking at this from a slightly different standpoint. So you have two things going on here, ultimately, in this paragraph. You have the idea of the son who is put under guardians and trustees coming of age and receiving the full rights of the heir. And this would, of course, relate to our coming to Christ initially. But then you also have the idea here of yet a future step, that now that we are sons and that we have God's Spirit in the heart, nevertheless, there's still an inheritance to come. This is the typical New Testament tension of the already and the not yet. So already we are heirs. We've come into the inheritance because we are God's children, no longer slaves under the elements. But on the other hand, we still are looking ahead to the full experience of our inheritance. When God does finish his work in us, brings us ultimately into the new heaven and the new earth through resurrection, transforms our bodies so that we can live in that new heaven and new earth in transformed bodies forever. 4:1-7, Paul concluding his argument by helping the Galatian Christians understand that even as Gentiles, they now have come into this glorious inheritance. And to go back to the law would be to go back to this era of slavery, to this era of being minors, to this era in which they were still being prepared for something rather than experiencing the full benefits of it. 4:8-20. This whole section, you might remember in our kind of overview, I think it's going to take forever to get back there, so maybe I'm not even going to try. This part of Galatians, you have the initial exhortation 3:1-6, bracketed, as we're going to see, by 5:1-12, but then in the middle of it, you have this other appeal. And so you have, again, a sequence of appeal, argument, appeal, argument, appeal, obviously. And we've just looked at the first main argument of the central part of the letter, 3:7-4:7 now. Paul turns directly to the Galatians and tries to say things to them very specifically about how they need to take action in light of the theology he's been talking about. Formerly, when you did not know God, you were slaves to those who by nature are not gods. But now that you know God, or rather are known by God, interesting sort of mid-course correction Paul makes, or mid-course addition maybe is a better way to put it. Yes, we know God, but more fundamental is the fact that God has come into knowledge of us. That is the prior issue. That's the more fundamental matter. Not that we know him, but that he has come into knowing us. How is it you're turning back to those weak and miserable forces? This is, again, the stoicheia. Do you wish to be enslaved by them all over again? You're observing special days, months, seasons, and years. We talked about that. I fear for you that somehow I have wasted my efforts on you. Again, as Paul did in the beginning of the letter, he's pretty blunt about how serious he thinks the situation is. Using really strong language here. You know, you're going back to slavery. You're putting yourself back under your pagan past, those who are not gods. That's what embracing the law is actually going to mean for you, Paul says. And again, I just reiterate how daring the move that Paul is making here to suggest that the Jewish law falls into that kind of a category.
Could this be suggesting that maybe these people were synagogue Gentiles, or they were God-fearers, and so we use beggarly elements of the law because they were perhaps trying to subject themselves to the law before they became Christians? In other words, they were attached to the synagogues.
Yeah.
And so he's not really talking about necessarily their pagan background, but their previous experiences in the synagogue.
It's possible. And certainly, I think that many of the Gentile converts of Paul's did have that kind of background. They came out of an experience of knowing something about Israel's God and knowing Israel's scriptures because they were interested in the Jewish faith, kind of onlookers, as it were, casual visitors to the synagogue without becoming Jews. I don't honestly see much evidence of that in Galatians. The strength of the language he uses here and the very fact he brings in words like elements of the world suggests to me he's talking more about a pagan past. When he uses the language here, for instance, you were slaves to those who by nature are not gods. I don't think Paul would ever have described Jewish experience that way. I just doubt that that would be the language he would use to talk about people who were in the context of some Jewish experience and now were tempted to go back to it, those who are by nature not gods.
Yeah, so if you take it, you've applied it, the stoicheia, to the law previously, and you were stunned by it.
Yeah.
It is stunning. I mean,
it's possible,
It's one of the most, I mean, usually I'm pretty unaffected by people saying that Paul had a low view of the law. But in this is probably one of the, if he's talking about Torah here, that is one of the most negative statements that you could have.
Yeah, he's associating the Torah with these elements. I don't think he's identifying it. I think we have to kind of be careful not to say more than Paul wants to say. It's the sort of argument we sometimes make, and again, I'm not saying there's no truth to what Paul's saying. I'm not saying he's spoken falsely, but again, he's in the heat of rhetoric. Kind of argument we sometimes make, you know, well, if you're going to do that, then you might as well, you know, do such and so. I'm I'm bad at thinking of illustrations and parallels, but I think you kind of get a sense of the kinds of arguments we can sometimes make, where we're saying, yeah, there is some point of association, but I don't want to identify them. And that's where, again, language of by nature not gods goes a little bit further than I think Paul would go in talking about a Jewish past.
If they were God-fearers or synagogue Gentiles, they would explain why they would have this predisposition to kind of lean towards being Judaized. I mean, it, you know,
that would still be an attractive thing for them. Yeah, yeah. Another factor that we're going to talk about a little bit more when we come into chapters 5 and 6, and again, something we could easily ignore, that in our New Testament context, as we're reading the letters, to try to think about how things actually were on the ground, as it were. Sometimes I think we can think very abstractly and in kind of an ideal way about what the ancient church was like, but we're dealing with people who are obviously immersed in their culture. There are pressures from their society on them in various ways. Just as you analyze any of your churches here, yeah, you can look at it from a theological standpoint, but then you look at it from the standpoint of, yeah, I've got these families that are quarreling, and I've got people who are affected by society in these ways and those ways. We know that people are not just these spiritual creatures. They are very earthly creatures as well. And kind of related to the point you're making, David, a lot of people think that one of the reasons the Galatians might have been very attracted to Judaism is because of the security of a system it offered them. People who have maybe found security in the pagan system they were once in, identifying with the local temple, going to the meals there, welcome as a fellow member of the religion, all the kind of sense of belonging, sense of identity that gives you. Now, Paul has come along, and they've come to this faith in Christ. Yeah, and maybe these churches are just getting their start, perhaps, but there's not much going on there. There's not much identity there yet. And so these agitators come along and say, hey, you know, you don't need to be sort of left out there in the wilderness without a home. You can take your Christian faith, bring it into a Jewish context, and become part of the synagogue. You can belong to us and put yourself under the law, which gives you nice, neat, clear guidance for how you're supposed to live. There's great security. There's a good sense of belonging and community that you're going to have here. I suspect that was a strong part of the attraction for these people, not just the theological arguments one way or the other, but that ability, again, to be connected to a well-defined, clearly structured group of people. We all know how that works in our day, how people are attracted to that. I know a number of evangelicals who have converted to Roman Catholicism partly for that reason. And I think, you know, sometimes we don't fully appreciate how strong a pull that can be for people. Steve, then Hugh.
Yeah. On the tying back in somewhat with the Slakia and this as well, I'll give you my read on it real quick, and then I'd like to hear if I'm off or not in your view. Paul, throughout Galatians, is drawing a sharp dichotomy between old age, new age, doing the law versus faith, spirit versus flesh, or flesh versus spirit. So is he using maybe slightly deliberately ambiguous language in order to lump following Torah and the paganism together, link them to material, in order to put them on that side of the dichotomy?
Yeah, the kind of thing I'm talking about here, yes. I think he is trying to find language that can bridge the two experiences, if I may put it that way.
This all belongs to that side of the dichotomy. You've left that behind.
Yeah.
Is that what he's doing?
Yeah, that just as, you know, for these Galatian Christians in a more personal way, your pagan past is your past. So the law belongs to a past era of salvation history. It's part of the past as well. And there's, again, the commonality at that point. You go back to that, you're going back to something you've already left behind that has had in itself rather negative consequences. The law, again, given because to stimulate transgression, the law is locked up under sin. Paul said pretty negative things about what the law has accomplished in chapter 3, and telling the Galatians, why do you want to go back to that? That's kind of the effect it's had. Not going so far as to suggest it's not God's law in some sense. It certainly is for Paul. Hugh?
Well, to contextualize it, in this current age, we have congregations that come out of Islam, and yet they become exclusivistic. They're worshiping Jesus, but want to follow a lot of the culture and practices of the Muslims. And yes, they're Christian, but people who didn't come out of that background find themselves very much left out of the practices in the church.
Yeah. I mean, it's a problem, isn't it, to figure out what in that Muslim culture has to be left behind and what is more sort of neutral that can be maintained when people come to faith in Christ. Those are not easy decisions to make sometimes.
Thank you for listening to this lecture brought to you by biblicaltraining.org. Feel free to make copies of this lecture to give to others, but please do not charge for these copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit our website at www.biblicaltraining.org. There you will find the finest in evangelical teaching for use in the home and the church, and it is absolutely free. Our curriculum includes classes for new believers, lay education classes, and seminary-level classes taught by some of the finest seminary teachers drawn from a wide range of evangelical traditions.